Hello, everyone. I'm Harry Blazer. We're talking from Kalispell, Montana, and we have Catherine Austin Fitz with us. Today, our audio seminar is entitled, Where Would Jesus Bank? It's actually part of the Coming Clean series about how to choose a bank. Catherine, welcome.
Hi, Harry. It's great to be doing an audio seminar with you.
Catherine, in the Coming Clean process, wouldn't you rate this one of the three most important things besides shutting off your TV, eating properly, and choosing the right bank?
Absolutely.
So how can you help us?
Well, I think the first thing we need to do is just take an overview of what is a bank and what is the banking system. A bank is a financial institution that takes deposits. So most of us have a checking account or a savings account. We put our money in our checking account, and then the bank processes our financial transactions. So, Harry, let's say I was going to send you a check for $100 for your Christmas or birthday present. You would deposit your check in your checking account, and then our banks would process that money between us. So a bank takes deposits, and it processes transactions, and then it provides a third function, which is to provide lending. It takes the deposits that it has and other monies that it collects, and it facilitates lending within our communities.
Now, of course, banks do a lot of other things these days now that the banking laws have been changed, but these have basically been the traditional functions of banks.
Absolutely. The banking system has taken on an incredible number of products and services. But at the core, the banking system is taking deposits, processing transactions, and loaning money. And that's, you know, you get that right and you've got yourself a good bank. Currently in the United States, there's approximately $8 trillion of deposits. That's about 30,000 in deposits per resident. And so you can see that's a very significant size and very significant part of the financial system. The banking system in America is highly centralized. We have both national and international regulators that control. And on the event resource page, we've created a series of links both to all the big regulators and other government agencies, which are so important to liquidity in these functions in banks. And so it's very important to understand the U.S. banking system, to understand how highly centralized and how centrally controlled it is.
Quick question. When you talked about $8 trillion in deposits, I guess you're talking about checking accounts as well as all kinds of savings accounts,
right,
too.
Right, and certificate of deposits. And we're talking about both banks and credit unions.
And you mentioned also that there are international regulators that the U.S. banks are subject to?
Capital regulations are now subject to international regulations. And in 1989, we saw the institution of international capital regulations, which is very much driven, helped to drive the consolidation in the U.S. banking system. In the last 20 years, we've seen very significant consolidation. And there is a direct relationship, Harry, between the consolidation of our banking deposits and banking business with the centralization of political and economic power and globalization. I mean, for example, if you're upset that jobs are moving abroad, then what we all need to understand is we're banking at the big banks that are facilitating and lending money to that process and shutting off capital to small business. We've watched, as this consolidation has occurred, a process in which small business is paying significantly more for its cost of capital than big business. And part of that is that our banking deposits have been centralized into the big banks. And the other is that our small businesses are dependent on banks. They don't have access to liquid equity markets like the big companies do. And so whether it's our deposits or investments, we've been voting with our money for the big guys against the small guys. And we're all suffering, whether it's our jobs are moved abroad or our communities are being drained of economic resources.
I know that centralization held out a couple dreams. One was better efficiency. I think the other was, you might say, more professionalism. But it seems all the time centralization goes hand in hand with monopolization, piratization, increase in secrecy or lack of transparency, and also actually an increase in fraud, too. Have you seen
that? Centralization has brought a whole world of corruption. And let's walk through the different ways that the banks are draining us, because it's significant and it's important. If I'm going to take the time to shift my bank accounts, it's very important for me to see the connection between how the big banks are draining me and how that connects with my voting with my deposits for the big banks. It's all part of seeing our power to shift things. The first, to me, and most important is the U.S. banking system is organized around our central bank, Federal Reserve System, which is a system of private banks who control essentially our financial system with a system of really zero accountability. The lead bank in that system, the New York Federal Reserve Bank, is the depository for the U.S. government, which means they are the bank to our federal government. Since 1998, we've seen over $4 trillion go missing from our federal government. That amount of money going missing, I mean, if you ran your business and a significant portion of money was disappearing from the books and from the accounts, your bank would shut you off or the SEC would shut you off. You'd never be allowed to engage in that kind of fraudulent activity as soon as it became something that your banker understood. So if the federal government is missing $4 trillion, then it left on the train tracks of the New York Fed and the depositories arranged by the New York Fed, i.e. it couldn't happen unless the banking system was supporting it and facilitating it in that size. And so we're seeing a very direct relationship between the financial corruption at the federal government and the banks who basically, at this point, really control what happens financially within the government and between the government and the private sector.
$4 trillion, how do you know it's missing?
Because the government has reported it missing. In other words, I was part of a group of officials in the first Bush administration who got laws passed requiring audited financial statements. The federal government to date has refused to produce audited financial statements. But in the process of reporting that they hadn't or couldn't, they've reported that they have undocumentable transactions. And from the agencies that we've been able to identify, so far, it's now over $4 trillion of undocumentable transactions.
Why is that the same as losing it?
You have to presume, let me give you an example. Let's say you had a checking account, and your checking account was off by $59,000. So HUD in fiscal 1999 was missing $59 billion. So let's say your checking account was $59,000 different than you showed it to be. Would you write something that said undocumentable transaction, $59,000, and never reconcile and find out if the mistake was yours or your banker's?
And it seems because the Fed is basically handling all the transactions, that if you really wanted to find out where the money went, you can go back and look at all those transactions.
Absolutely. There's no way, given the nature of bank accounts and clearing systems, there's no way that an undocumentable transaction cannot be identified and resolved. Now, what an accountant will tell you is there's some portion of undocumentable transactions which are so de minimis it's not worth our time to find them. But $4 trillion is clearly not that amount of money. You're talking about amount of money in some years which is greater than the total amount of tax receipts in that year. Now, people say, how can we possibly be missing more money than we had tax receipts in that year? And that's where security frauds comes in. There are significant patterns and allegations of significant securities frauds at the Treasury and at government agencies like the one that I was leader at. And the combination of securities fraud with this kind of refusal to produce audited financial statements where the banks are complicit can, in fact, lead to, we don't know how much in cash is missing or how much is gone in terms of fraudulent securities, but we know it's very significant.
You have an incredible situation where basically people claim incompetence oftentimes, where it's actually negligence. I mean, here you have in the 9/11 situation, the greatest military in the world that knows basically where every fly is in the sky, but yet they can't find four hijacked airliners. And here you have the Fed that has incredible capabilities in terms of tracking transactions all around the world, and they can't be of assistance in helping us find lost government money.
Well, the federal government is in essence not run by government officials. It's run, because we are in a deficit position, it's run by a group of big banks and corporate contractors, mostly defense contractors. And what we know is every one of them is capable of producing books or cooking their books every year. And so we pay them hundreds of millions of dollars, well, really billions of dollars to do the accounting and depository work for the U.S. government. And so it's not possible that incompetence is the answer. I mean, I ran a very significant accounting and securities operation in the U.S. government, and what I'll tell you is incompetence is not the reason. I mean, there's no reason that that group of government employees couldn't produce excellent books and excellent performance. So if we're not getting it, it has nothing to do with incompetence. It has to do with a systemic governance of the resources for in very intentional ways. I mean, we know, I've written significantly about the black budget. We know with the black budget, we're watching very significant siphoning off of resources outside of the Constitution, supposedly under the pretext of the National Security Law and the CIA Act. And that's a topic that we've discussed in other audio seminars. But suffice it to say, if an American citizen is concerned about government corruption, then they have to ask themselves, why am I banking at one of the banks who is leading that corruption? Not just complicit, leading that corruption. In 1998, in fact, I was sitting in a mansion in my beautiful home in Washington, and in the middle of litigation with the federal government, I realized I'm banking at the private banking groups at J.P. Morgan Chase and Citibank, which are the very banks that are running HUD on a corrupt basis. Why am I doing this? Why am I banking at the very people who are responsible for the very corruption I say I hate and trying to stop.
And helping to give you a hard time, too.
Right. So I'm financing my own hard time. In other words, they're giving me a hard time financed with my money. And I said, this is ridiculous. I'm going local. I'm going to pull my money out of the big banks and I'm going local. I'm going to find a clean, well-managed local bank. And I'm not going to finance my own destruction. Let's say my bank is making mortgage loans into a neighborhood. So they make a 1,000 mortgage loans a year. Now, if narcotics trafficking comes into my neighborhood or for whatever reason my neighborhood starts to deteriorate, the bank's going to lose money, right?
It's supposed to.
Right. Now, that's where federal credit comes along. Let's say we insure the bank deposits with FDIC insurance and we insure the mortgages with FHA and VA guarantees and other guarantees, then suddenly we can start to have a community that deteriorates tremendously, and the banks don't care. They're making money. They're making money on processing the mortgages, whether they default or not. They're making money on the various deposits that they're taking and their use of those deposits as they move it out of the community. So a community can fail. And they can make money. The perfect example was last year in 2004, the American households were reported by Northern Trust as having a deficit of $342 billion, whereas the banks had a record year in profits. And the top 20 banks that we cite on the event resource page, we call them the Tapeworm 20, made profits of $89 billion. So you're seeing a situation where, thanks to the federal credit, the banks, particularly the big banks, can make a profit as the country is failing. So communities failing, people failing, jobs moving abroad makes money for the big guys, but it's engineered through the federal credit. Let me give you another example. We saw a process in the 80s where there was significant financial corruption and fraud. And coming out of that period, some of the big banks were literally bankrupt. I was on the board of Sallie Mae at the time with seven vice chairmen of seven big banks. And the big conversation was Citibank had negative equity. Were the regulators going to shut it down or was it too big to fail? And we watched a process, Harry, where the Federal Reserve Bank engineered profits. And I described this in the story, The Myth of the Rule of Law, which is linked on the event resource page, but literally engineered huge profits to the banking system. Now, what that meant was if they failed to perform and they were essentially bankrupt, they got dug out by backdoor subsidies through the Federal Reserve and the US Treasury. Now, if a small business got caught up in the absence of liquidity or the down cycle in the economy, they failed. So the little guys are constantly put in a position of failing, but the big guys, you know, if they fail, they make money, and if they don't fail, they make money. So we're in a two-tier system where the rules that apply to them are different than the rules that apply to all of us. The problem being is every time we bail them out, it's with our money. And so we've watched a process over the last 20 years where corporations become increasingly unproductive and inefficient. But whether it's rigging privatization through the government, whether it's rigging government contracts or playing with the federal credit, it doesn't matter how inefficient they are, how much they fail to perform, what damage they do, they make more money. And so none of that could work unless you can run the federal government on a corrupt basis, refuse to produce audited financial statements, continue to engage in what appears to be securities fraud. That's the financial mechanism that makes all of this go. Shut that off and you shut off the gas supply to what is now a corporate and banking army that is literally destroying the planet.
Thus, the strategy for local banking.
Right.
Okay. Now, this might be a good point to mention that whenever you purchase either access to the live seminar, which then, of course, you get access to the MP3 recording afterwards, or purchase the CD, that you have access to the resource page
right.
with an incredible number of links and additional information. So it's not just the audio seminar. You're also getting access right. to this wonderful asset.
Right. And at the event resource page, there's a link to post your questions at the Solari Action Forum. So questions keep coming in, and we keep answering them.
Into many weeks from now.
Oh, yes.
Okay, so we're in the process here of establishing a basis for why local banking makes sense. It's something that we want to do. Are there more things that you want to add to what you've said?
Yeah, quickly, if you look at the retail sales in any community, a significant amount of profits are being skimmed off with the use of credit cards. And more, that's a big bank business. And so literally walk into a store, walk into a restaurant and calculate what the cost is in terms of profits to that community of a big bank credit card being used. It's fantastic. So that's a sort of what I think of as a third way that the big banks are draining us. Another is narcotics trafficking. We have another audio seminar, Narco Dollars for Beginners, that goes into the significance of narcotics trafficking, both as a financial business in the United States and its role in harming communities. But if you look at who's complicit in what is now $500 billion to $1 trillion a year of money laundering, of which Narco Dollars is a piece, it's the same banks that come up again and again. I know I tell the story of being at a money laundering conference in Miami, and the head of compliance from the Bank of New York and the head of compliance at Citibank sat down at my table, didn't realize who I was. I was sitting in blue jeans with a group of women who were speaking Spanish and started talking about how they laundered money for the agency right in front of me. So I think it's another
reason. By the agency, you mean the CIA?
They didn't tell me and I didn't ask. I assumed it was the CIA. Compromise of private data. In recent months, we've seen again and again and again stories of Citibank losing our data, the big banks again and again giving access to our private data to Lord knows who. One of the links at the event resource book is a fiction novel called Black Money, which is a fictionalized account of the Promise software system, but it describes the extent to which our privacy has been compromised in all banks, but the big banks are particularly heinous on this point. So part of political and economic freedom is controlling and owning your own private data. Another reason to stay away from the big banks. Market manipulations. Most Americans have heard about Enron or the suppression of gold prices. If you read even the mainstream press and you say, okay, who is responsible for Enron? Who is responsible for the suppression of the gold? Who is responsible for pumping and dumping the telecom markets? What you find in story after story is it's the same banks. It's Citibank. It's JP Morgan Chase. It's the same banks over and over again. So, and these kinds of shenanigans have significant impact both on our retirement savings, our 401k, our pension funds. These are significant financial drains to every person in every community in America. But again, it's the same guys. Another form of drain is the extent to which the banks are complicit in what I call dirty tricks in economic warfare. And let me tell you a story. I was in the mid-90s. I was engaged in litigation. We were targeted by sort of a snitch with the Department of Justice. My company was doing loan sales for HUD at the time. And the lawyer for the snitch was a fellow named Dan Hawk, who was incredibly aggressive. They would file papers in courts, and they would walk in and literally lie. We have them on transcript, just lying with no basis of evidence. And I kept wondering, where in the world does this guy get the courage to simply, you know, just lie? And finally, I started to dig in, and it turned out that his father was Jerry Hawk, who was at the time the leading, had been the former general counsel of the Federal Reserve, and at the time was the leading banking regulator for the U.S. He was head of the Office of Comptroller of Currency. Well, I went through a process where literally our bank appeared to be teamed up with the other guys trying to literally destroy us. We have reason to believe they stole money from our accounts. They refused to produce statements about where our accounts were that we needed to file our taxes. We have reason to believe that they were conspiring to steal our tax refund. We know for a fact that they gave confidential private financial information to Dan Hawk's law firm. And then when we started to object to that, they hired Jerry Hawk's old law firm, Arnold and Porter. So we went through a process where, as a small business, not only were we dependent on the banking system for credit, but we were dealing with, in this case, a small community bank who was literally appeared in cahoots with corrupt federal regulators. If the banking system is going to be in cahoots with dirty regulators, that's a very scary picture if you're a small business.
So we have another level of complexity. It's not just a question of going local. It's going local with the right bank, too.
It's going local with the right bank, and it's taking responsibility to understand what your bank is doing with your money. In other words, in this kind of environment, I don't know what my bank was doing with my money, so I'm not to blame. We are responsible to know what our bank is doing with our money, or else we're not going to have an economy that's wonderful for us. In addition, what we've seen in the pattern of securities fraud is that we have reason to believe, and I've made the allegations in the Myth of the Rule of Law, again, linked from the event resource page, that in mortgage-backed securities, the bank are engaged in fraudulent trustee practices, which means, let's say I take 1,000 mortgages, pull them into securities, I appoint a bank as the trustee, and their job is to make sure that the collateral is really there. Now, if what appears to be the case really is true, what it means is our pension funds and our 401ks and our IRAs are buying securities which are fraudulently issued because the banks are going along with saying that or using collateral twice or three times on different securities. So if that kind of practice is going on, and we've certainly seen banks caught out doing fraudulent trustee practices, and I have links to a story, Piracy on the Delaware, which is a perfect example of that. So another drain is fraudulent trustee practices. Finally, in the article, Where Would Jesus Bank?, we have a list of all the banks in Lou Dobbs's list from CNN of the big banks who are moving jobs abroad. We've seen the big banks move jobs abroad, and we've seen them finance moving other jobs abroad. Let's say you have a manufacturing plant in Idaho, and most of your workers are banking at Idaho National Bank. If I'm Citibank and I come in and help the manufacturing group move to India in a construct where I get the banking business once it gets to India, that is part of the sort of big bank game. So we've seen these banks complicit in both the process to move jobs abroad and to benefit from moving their own jobs and other people's jobs. Now, why is that important? I was part of a group in Washington during the 90s that said, hey, globalization is happening. We're going to be moving lots of jobs abroad. We need to improve skills in this country. We need to pay down our debt because as we move jobs abroad, we won't be able to afford the level of debt we have, and we need to improve workforce skills and do a series of things, and this is what I call the Solari model, to help small businesses access capital so small businesses can create new jobs. But we didn't do that, Harry. What we did was instead we made a command decision with the leadership of the big banks and their role in government and said we're going to significantly increase the amount of debt that the average American carries. We're going to increase government debt. We're going to increase consumer debt. We're going to increase housing debt. We have an audio seminar called Navigate the Housing Bubble. What I'm saying is the leadership of the banking system and the financial system purposefully and intentionally encouraged Americans to take on huge amounts of debt, directly or indirectly, when they knew that they were going to move the jobs abroad and Americans' income were going to fall.
Kind of takes the mystery out of where we're in a jam, eh?
Well, but here's the important point. There are standards under the law that say if I encourage you to borrow money from me when I know you can't pay it back for reasons that I know but I have not fully disclosed to you, that is called fraudulent inducement. And under common law, the American people may not owe the banks that money because that debt may have been fraudulently induced.
How do you think that case will get settled when it goes to the Supreme Court?
Well, no, under common law, Americans have, in theory, the right of offset. They have the right to simply offset against their taxes or offset against the amounts they owe. And I would suggest, you know, the time is coming when enough lawyers, enough accountants, enough experts are going to help us figure out what are our rights. But that's, you know, that's a campaign for another day. But I think there is a very serious question that needs to be asked. What and how much of the governmental and mortgage and credit card debt in this country was fraudulently induced? Because I think the number is very significant.
So if you don't mind, Catherine, you've maybe given us a list of 10, 11, 12 reasons why we shouldn't be banking with
these big banks.
Do you mind just running down what they are?
Big banks are draining us. They are draining us by running our government corrupt. They are draining us in how they work with the federal credit. They are draining us in how credit cards skim money from our communities. They are draining us by participating and tolerating narcotics trafficking and money laundering related to our communities. They are draining us by not being trustworthy to keep our private data private. They are draining us through market manipulations. They are draining us by participating in dirty tricks and economic warfare against small business. They are draining us with fraudulent trustee practices. They are draining us by moving jobs abroad and facilitating lending that moves jobs abroad. And they are draining us through the fraudulent inducement of debt.
Okay, so I guess any one of those, you wouldn't want to be associated, you know, doing business with folks. But never mind, you know, if half of them are right. But, I mean, from your experience, you know that all of them are right.
All of them are right.
Okay,
And so why would we bank with somebody why would we bank with a financial vampire?
As a matter of fact, if we were engaged in transactions with criminals in ordinary life, we'd end up actually getting indicted ourselves, right?
Right.
Okay, so now you have a list of the top 20 tapeworm banks? How did you describe it?
Right. If you're in one of these banks, in my opinion, you don't need to think, just get your money out of that bank.
Okay, so quickly, why don't you go over what those 20 are? I know it's on the resource page.
Number one is Bank of America. Number two is, and this is in alphabetical order. We're not ranking them in terms of worst. Bank of America, Bank of New York, Barclays, BB&T, Citibank, Citigroup, Citizens, Credit Suisse, Deutsche Bank, HSBC, J.P. Morgan Chase, Mellon, Merrill Lynch, PNC, Royal Bank of Canada, State Street, Sumitomo, SunTrust, UBS, Wachovia, Wells Fargo. Their total net income last year was $89 billion, while U.S. households had a deficit of $342 billion. And that's what a tapeworm is. A tapeworm is a parasite that does better as you do worse.
So the alternative to not banking with the big banks, the national banks in most cases, or sometimes international banks, is to find a good local bank.
Yes.
Okay, but that's more than just picking up the yellow pages and closing your eyes and pointing.
Correct.
Do we want to hear from Peg Stewart at this point?
Absolutely.
So this little anecdotal story might be of interest to folks. Hello, Peggy.
Here I am. Peggy, why don't you start off with telling the story of how you came to find a local bank.
All right, I'd be happy to do that.
Well, the first thing I had to do was to make a decision to change from my great big bank to a local bank, and I had a lot of fear and anxiety because I had been banking at this big bank for 30 years. But once I got over that, I said, well, now how am I going to find a local bank? How am I going to do that? And so I went to the phone book, the Yellow Pages, and I found, I eliminated all the big ones right away, and then I got down to about five, and then I called up Catherine. I said, Catherine, how am I going to find a bank here? I have about five of them here. And so she said, well, just think about what you want in a bank. And so I did, and so I visited these different banks, and I kind of went in there, and I wanted to sense, what is the bank like? What are the employees like? Do they like what they're doing here? Are they happy employees? What did I sense about the bank in general? How was I received when I walked in? And then once getting past that, then I talked to some people, and I said, oh, I'm interested in becoming a depositor, and I'd like to know a few things about your bank, and ask for a financial statement, and three of the five didn't know what I was talking about, so I kind of eliminated them right away. It was a very interesting process just to kind of to ask for a financial statement was a big step for me. Like, I would like a financial statement. But anyway, so I had a little things that I wanted to know, like what was unique about their bank and where would my money go and what's their community involvement. And I also was interested in their reaction for why I wanted to leave the big bank, which was because I didn't like what was happening with my money that I deposited in there. It was supporting things that I had no interest in or didn't believe in. So anyway, I got down to this one bank. It's called the Business Bank. I'm a Nevadan, so the Business Bank of Northern Nevada. And I walked in, and I was greeted right away by a real person, not a robot, directing me to the appropriate line. And they sat down with me, and I asked them for a financial statement. She reached right down in the drawer and pulled one out. She said, let me see if this is the most current. And it was, and everything. So we went over that. And then I started to tell her why I wanted to change banks, because I didn't like, the way the big banks were doing business with my money. And she said, we all moved from big banks in here for the same reason. It's too impersonal. And then some person from out in the other room said, I was over at this big bank. And then another person from another room, I was over at this one. And it was really a neat experience. They didn't like what they were doing or how the customers were treated in those big banks. So they all got together and created this bank. And the manager came out and personally introduced himself to me. And he sat down and told me the history and the story of this particular bank. And I could see that he and the other employees really cared about what they were doing and what kind of a business they wanted to be. They were all really validated that I had taken the time to research them and the hard work that they'd done to become a clean bank. And I told them, you know what? The reason I'm choosing you guys is because you came clean, financially and in other ways. And they were just all really validated by that because that's what they had been striving for. And then I went back a couple of days later to sign some papers, and the manager of the whole Northern Nevada business banks happened to be at the bank, and he said he wanted to meet me, and he had heard my story, and he was really validated as well. He was really happy that he wanted to hear it from me, why I had chosen the business bank. And he invited me to a party with the Secretary of State. So,
one of the things... The honest bankers have had such a difficult time over the last 20 years that it's hard for most people to understand how energizing it is for them to get real support from the customer base.
Mm-hmm.
So Peg's story is wonderful because it shows, not just we're pulling our money from the tapeworm, but we're putting our money behind people who'd really like to try and run things honestly. And the energy they can get when they just get a little bit of, reminds me of, in the movie Patton when Bradley says, give George a headline and he's good for another 60 miles. So they can get a lot of energy from a little bit of customer support.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And, you know, the bank is kind of like the channel that all our money goes through. It's a channel how your money comes to you and how it leaves you. And I had no idea that I was going to feel so good about changing the bank, about coming clean on that level. I mean, I feel really good when I get my statement, when I write a check or make a deposit, because I know that my money's going to circulate around the community, supporting local businesses and people before it leaves. And right. I just feel really good about that now. I had no idea that that was going to happen, that I was going to feel this good.
I find that if you can find a good local bank, the customer service is extraordinary compared to what you're used to if you've been banking at a big bank.
Yes.
You know, if you find a really excellently managed local bank, a much greater part of their profits comes from doing good bread-and-butter business for local business, local organizations, and local customers. And so if you find a good local bank, then you're finding an organization for which the fundamental economics work. They're not making money on, you know, offshore Enron scams, on trading derivatives, on doing dirty deeds for the Exchange Stabilization Fund. Mm-hmm. They're making money from basic, real, productive things. And so they really care about each customer and performing on the fundamental basics of their business.
Peggy, thank you very much for sharing that with us.